This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Since the end of the Civil War to the current trend of charter schools and vouchers, the American education system has been under pressure to integrate and provide an equal school experience for all. And for a while there, it was working.
Since we've gone back to a kind of separate but equal mentality, we're seeing those same achievement gaps widen again.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the head of American Studies at Cornell University about segregation, privatization, and what she sees as the current crisis in public education in the U.S. We'll also spend an academic minute seeing if liberal education can bring leadership to the country. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Segronomics, that's a word that today's guest says describes the current experimental solutions to the so-called racial achievement gap in schools, including charters, vouchers, and cyber schools that rely on, profit from, and ultimately exacerbate disturbingly high levels of racial and economic segregation under the guise of providing equal opportunity. Noliwe Rooks is the director of American Studies and an associate professor in Africana Studies at Cornell University. She talks about the issues surrounding inequality in U.S. schools in her new book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public School. I spoke with Dr. Rooks and asked why she needed to tell this story.
You know, it was honestly trying to figure out why I was seeing so many students on campus. At the time, I was teaching at Princeton University when I decided to do this book. And every time I turned around, there were groups of students organizing field trips to inner city schools to, you know, talk about the inequality of urban education, or inviting the Secretary of Education to campus, or having different events and films and screenings. And it really went from sort of background noise to a real kind of crescendo of interest by very, very privileged students, many of whom had never been in an urban school. Many went to public schools, but they went to sort of high-achieving suburban public schools. They had just no knowledge or interaction with these kinds of schools or the communities or the people who attended those schools. And so at some point, you know, while I was celebrating all of this interest for vulnerable students, was trying to figure out, but why? Why now? Like, why all of a sudden do you have students who don't know anything about these people or these neighborhoods putting all of their time and attention and deciding their careers based on, you know, wanting to eradicate what they were often calling the civil rights issue of our time? And so just trying to unravel that, and this was in 2010, so, and then my then present, I kept trying to sort of back up to the beginnings of certain kinds of relationships between earnest white people and wealthy entrepreneurs and captains of industry and public education. And so I kept backing up farther and farther and farther until I bumped into Reconstruction.
Get to the book in a second. I'm just very interested. How did those students react once they got there, once they got to the inner city schools and the less privileged schools and saw what was going on?
Well, there were different reactions. Some of them, I mean, one of the things that I consistently saw was when they rolled up their sleeves and wanted to help, the ways that they wanted to help always had to do with the kind of students that they were and the kind of educations that they had gotten. So in one project in particular that was in the Trenton public school system, which was really struggling, a majority of, I think it was 90% black and Latino, there were so few white students in the Trenton public school system at the time that they could not report test scores by race because they had confidentiality issues. There were so few white students that the scores for the white students, you would know exactly who you're talking about in each school. And everybody was under the poverty level. So the students coming in saying, okay, we want to propose some things. We want to do some things differently and help. Let's start a tutoring program. Let's do some reading. Let's get some books for them. And they started choosing books. These were fifth and sixth graders. The way that they decided to do it is just an example, was to pick the books that they most like. These are all white students and all high achieving. They're all, you know, at Princeton, all AP honor students. So they were choosing books that they liked, things like Edgar Allan Poe I, too, loved Edgar Allan Poe. And I want to say right around 12, 13, I was doing deep dives into Poe. But the population that we were interacting with just simply did not have the background or skills or cultural literacy for that to make any sense. And they were like fighting the experts saying, but if you want them to excel, you know, you need to give them these really hard books to read, and not understanding why it was frustrating the students, leading to all kinds of other problems. In the end, the whole thing ended up falling apart. But that didn't stop them. Like they, so I think last I heard, the group that had started this went off to work for an educational venture capitalist firm. So they were going to fund other students at Princeton and other places to do other kinds of projects just like this one that didn't work.
Well, let's get back to Reconstruction.
Yeah.
I mean, that was obviously an interesting time in our country. What did that look like then? What did the education system in the country look like then?
That's the period right after the Civil War when the federal government is trying to figure out, since this is a region of the country in the South that has been completely decimated, how do we help it rebuild, as well as how do we help the formerly enslaved find their footing in this region of the country where they were formerly slaves? So the federal government was sending massive amounts of money for rebuilding efforts to have troops there. And one of the things that they did was to send money to set up schools for both poor whites. I mean, wealthy whites had always in the South gone to school, but poor whites, you know, didn't have access to schools at any higher levels than did the formerly enslaved. So this money really went to, it did an amazing thing in that 13 years for raising literacy rates all across the region amongst poor whites as well as blacks. But at the end of Reconstruction, the issue became the white people in the region weren't willing to go back to being uneducated, but they didn't have the money to continue, you know, building schools, paying teachers, getting supplies. So Reconstruction ends, and they sort of start figuring out, well, we want to continue to grow our literacy and our educational level, but we don't have the money to do it. Let's take the money that the government is still sending to educate the formerly enslaved, and let's use it to educate whites. And they started, all across the country, started making up laws that were saying things like, it is illegal to use money that educates white students to also educate black students. If taxes are the ways that we here in Mississippi are going to fund our educational system to continue to educate whites, then black people are going to have to pay a double tax. They're going to have to pay the regular tax to educate whites and then another one to educate black people if that's what they want. If they built schools, you know, churches want to build schools, that's fine, but the schools cannot be better than any white schools that are built anywhere in the area. They have to intentionally be constructed, not using the same plans. You can't use the same wood. So it really enacted this real separate but equal, like at the moment that you start seeing an expansion of public education, there really was this whole ethos of, it's not that we don't want black people to be educated. It's that they cannot be educated in the same ways that whites, in the same buildings or with white people, with the same curricula, the same books, none of it. It has to be completely separate.
There was the growth of something that you call company schools. Specifically, you talked about Tennessee Coal and Iron. Where did they come from and were they successful?
They were wildly successful. So Tennessee Coal and Iron is just one example. A lot of these big, like, steel companies and coal companies, manufacturing that's really getting going during this period, the 19th turn of the 20th century, the trying to keep a stable workforce, because, of course, slavery had allowed those in the South. Slavery was an economic engine for the entire country. Because you have free labor in the South was the economic engine for the entire country. In the absence of unpaid labor, the issue for manufacturers became, well, but how are we still going to make a profit if we have to start paying people? And when people have choices and can move around, you know, they're not just confined to one plantation, one region of the country, you know, they can pick up and go where they want to. How do we keep them here? And so for Tennessee Coal and Iron in particular, what they came up with was, let's promise the workers that we will educate their kids to the highest standards. And they had just company towns. So, you know, you could live, you live there, you shopped there, you went to church there. So the entire town that you lived in was owned by one of these manufacturing concerns. I mean, all of your social interactions were based around there. So, but in previously before Tennessee Coal and Iron, people had not been building company towns for black residents. It had only been for white residents. So they said, well, you know, we need to keep some of these black people in the South here in Alabama, because Tennessee Coal and Iron was actually in Alabama. So they said, so let's build schools. Let's have teachers. Let's use the same curricula that's used with white students. Let's use the same schools, have the same infrastructure, same teachers. Like, let's make it all equal and use that as a kind of recruiting tool. And it is one of the few educational experiments during that period, or really any period, that bore really, really strong results. The black students and the poor white students were performing at the highest levels because resources and infrastructure and curriculum and teachers were equalized across the board.
Does anything like that exist today?
No.
No.
There are some programs across the country that are sort of similar. So they're saying that they're six-year high school degrees. They really started in Chicago. There's some in New York State where you get your 4 years of high school, and basically you get a two-year community college degree. So you say you go to high school for 6 years, and when you come out, the company that has funded the school guarantees you an entry-level job. So in that way, it's kind of similar because it's training workers. And most of the places where this is tried, it's educating over like 96-97% are black and Latino students exclusively, and like 99% meet poverty levels, you know, free lunch as a marker for poverty and economic vulnerability. So it's for black and Latino students who are poor, overwhelmingly male, at least in the first few years. The last time I was looking at it, most of the students who were being targeted were male students. That's sort of similar. There's a similarity there in that when you come out, assuming that you are performing at a certain level, you get an entry-level job at, say, IBM. One of the first companies to really take this on was IBM. Microsoft is doing something similar, as are a number of healthcare concerns. It's still pretty early, but it's not clear that the education that students are getting are what we would consider at the highest levels. Although people are the first in their generation to go to college and are actually coming out earning, you know, jobs in the $40,000 range, which for their communities is often higher than anything else that they could look to.
Still to come, our conversation with Noliwe Rooks continues with a look at one of the biggest milestones in American education, the Brown v. Board of Education decision. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Noliwe Rooks, Director of American Studies and an Associate Professor in Africana Studies at Cornell University. We're talking about her new book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public School. In the book, she talks about the different reactions around the country to the landmark Supreme Court decision, Brown v. Board of Education.
The way that you learn about Brown v. Board, I guess in high school or just sort of socially, you know, it's like it's this great moment, this great breakthrough where we could really see that there was some moral rot at the center of the country and that we needed to move in different directions. And so in doing research for the book, seeing the numbers of times and the ways that whites were enraged by this, like they really thought that the Supreme Court was siding with black people over them, like whole entire communities, whole entire state legislatures was saying, why, in order to give black people these rights to integrated education, why do our desires for segregated education have to be trampled on? You know, we don't want to go to school with them. And the Supreme Court coming along and just deciding they don't live here, they don't have to sit in these classrooms, they don't have to sit in these communities. There was a massive resistance to this. the scope of which I was just simply unaware of. It went from violence and attempted rapes of young children. There's some autobiographies that talk about the day it was announced, you know, walking home from school and having a white men specifically target little girls as an act of power and saying, you know, I'll show you the Supreme Court cannot tell me what to do as they're attempting to rape 10, 11, 12-year-old girls. Emmett Till, who was famously lynched in the South and led to a certain kind of formation of the civil rights movement. This is just a few months after Brown v. Board. You had entire school systems that shut down the entire thing so no one could get an education, white or black, if it meant that there had to be integrated education. And the Congress, the U.S. Congress, there were 100 Congress, Senate, and congressional members who issued a document that they called Massive Resistance, the Massive Resistance document, all about how they were planning to join together and use every means at their Senate and congressional and gubernatorial discretion to make sure integration didn't come about. So I think one of the things we were writing the book was just I had no idea how organized and how unwilling so many white communities were to thinking about integration. I'd always thought of it as this great moment where, like, the country is living out its ideals. So one of the things that comes out of that, though, is a precursor to what we call charter schools, because they're these privately run but publicly financed segregation academies. Basically, private schools pop up all over the South. Milton Friedman, who was an economist at the University of Chicago, you know, came up with this, not in order to help aid segregation, he would point out, just that he thought this was a better way to run schools. But segregationists and white supremacists locked onto it and were like, yes, that's what we need to do. We need to go back to figuring out how the federal government can pay for whites to be educated separate from blacks and not pay as much to have black people educated. So that's the South. And it's at least 10, 12 years before you see any real integration take place, and really 20 before you start to see a real uptick in the South. In the North, segregation was not written into law in the North. Like in the South, it really was. It is illegal for you to send your child to an integrated school. In the North, there were just no places that were actually saying that as a part of their public schools. But what happened is white communities were really had started to suburbanize from the mid to late 1950s on, and that's a pattern that started to accelerate in the 1960s, right when all of this is happening, right when Brown v. Board is 1954. You're having these white-only suburbs, places like Levittown, that do say, black people can't live here. So they didn't say the schools can't be integrated, but they did have the housing tracts and communities were segregated. So then the struggle for the North, of course, became how do you achieve integration when there's fewer whites with whom to integrate because they're moving to suburbs, or there's such massive resistance to busing, to the idea of busing white children or black children back and forth in order to achieve an education. How do you do it? So there was resistance to the idea, North and South.
What was the best time for education in the country, or is that yet to come?
There was a period from the 70s into the mid-80s, where if we're going to say best in terms of narrowing achievement gaps, which is usually what people talk about. So when the brief period of time after massive resistance, the back was broken, schools in the South started to integrate, and the early 80s, where then you started to see Western and Southern communities bring suit against some of the integration efforts. So there's about a 13, 14-year period there, where you do see test scores start leveling out. College dropouts are, you know, lessening. All of the things that, you know, in 1954 was hoped that integration would achieve, between about 1972, 1973, and about 83 to 85, you actually all over the country see that happening. You see the desegregation orders in the North that are, you know, some of which required suburbs to participate. You saw that actually have an uptick. It worked, you know, good things happen. So that, in terms of moments in this country where education has been readily available to all, the quality of the education was substantially similar, and the form of delivery, people were educated in the same building with the same teachers, that 13, 15-year period, I think, would be a high point, because since then, since we've gone back to a kind of separate but equal mentality, we're seeing those same achievement gaps widen again.
So look ahead. Things going to get better?
Well, we have to hope. I mean, there's a lot of real activity. We've seen a lot of progress. And one of the things that I also didn't know until I started doing this research was there are groups of students and communities all over the country that have really banded together to push back and to advocate for themselves and their schools and really make clear what kinds of educations they most want to have. I think given that kind of energy, and there's something heartwarming about, and, although I had to go looking for these stories, they're not all that easy to find, but once you look for them and know where to look, you see this is happening all over the country, that you have so many young people from middle school and high school who are advocating with mayors, with federal entities, with state legislatures, how to heighten their safety. They're big into restorative justice. They are all about, you know, not having police officers in schools. They want less testing, this high-stakes testing. They've organized themselves around that. In New York State in particular, in 2016, almost a quarter of parents and families who are in public schools opted out of taking tests as a way of protesting. Not in New York City so much, but in upstate New York. Kids who are sort of like, but you know, you're making determinations about my future with this testing that is impacting my days at school in ways that we just don't agree with. So I think if that type of energy keeps going, if we keep seeing, you know, people who are most impacted saying, this is what I want, that's what democracy looks like. And I think the more rather than less democracy is always a good thing.
Again, the name of Dr. Noliwe Rook's new book is Cutting School: Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public School. It's published by The New Press. Can a focus on liberal education bring increased leadership to the country? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Could a focus on liberal education help America's leadership in the world? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Damon Coletta, professor of political science at the United States Air Force Academy, delves into this question.
President Trump's trips abroad and major foreign policy announcements to the nation prompt vigorous debates at home among members of Congress, elite journalists, and academics about American leadership in the rest of the world. Specifically, whether and how the heavily burdened United States should keep commitments to support the global trading system, international peace, and human security. The United States remains the most powerful and technologically advanced nation on Earth, but faces mounting challenges to its vision in nearly every regional economic center. As the leading member of the international system since World War II, it is called to address transnational problems such as climate change and weapons proliferation that disdain boundaries and that no state can resolve alone. Scholars have studied liberal decline in international systems dating back to 5th century ancient Greece. Liberal education, with roots there in the Socratic Academy, emerged in part to preserve democracy by reducing popular pressure for racing headlong against rival states in technology and war. It encourages ordinary individuals from all walks of life to participate in self-government by directing hard questions toward an elected regime of fellow citizens. While liberal education predates modern science and engineering, in the same vein it teaches citizens to pursue sharp political issues with disciplined inquisitiveness, persistence, and openness that scientists evince in theories of nature. Contrary to conventional wisdom, liberal education does not deprecate technology or defense. It integrates science, results, and method to pursue wisdom about the structure of human relationships within a free society, among states, and at the transnational level. Americans wishing to escape the fate of Athenian democracy 100 generations ago or British parliamentary democracy 100 years ago might consider improving liberal educational practice as means for righting the political balance between technology for themselves and science for mankind.
That was Damon Coletta of the United States Air Force Academy. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.